Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
I mean, I just see a respecter of women.
This is Focus on the Family Minute, and Ashley Willis shares her thoughts on how Jesus treated women.
And I love that, and I do think it goes against what some people are trying to spread as a narrative today about him holding women down. And I mean, probably one of my favorite stories is the woman at the well. I just love how he went against really the cultural norms of his day to go and talk to this woman and minister to her and not bring necessarily like shame on her like others had done, but to show her that she didn't have to keep living in shame. She didn't have to keep living life this way, and that there was this living water that only he could offer her. And I just think it was just so beautiful. And I think it's important that we remember that, and that Jesus loves women, and he wants women to be respected, and he is the model that we all should follow.
More from Ashley and her husband Dave at familyminute.org.
Focus on the Family on AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Sculptera Winery and Sculpture Garden. The Frankel family and staff invite you to visit their beautiful world and taste their award-winning estate wine. Open daily 10 to 5 on Lanay Road in Paso Robles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Free Talk California with Susanna Luthi on AM 1230 KPRL 99.3 FM. Phone lines are open at 238-5775, 238-5775. KPRL. California Free Talk is brought to you by A-Town Diner in Atascadero on El Camino Real. Now open for dinner every night. Ask about the daily specials. And now, Free Talk California on The Right Choice, KPRL.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Free Talk California. I'm Susanna Luthi, and I'm very excited about today. My guest is Katie Talento. She is a Harvard-trained epidemiologist and former Trump White House health policy advisor and special assistant to the president. She was there when I was reporting, and I can just say that I would have done all kinds of sneaky things to be able to talk to her then as I'm talking to her today. She was very important, very key to all this, all the important decisions that we health reporters were trying to chase down through whispers and rumor, et cetera. Anyway, she had spent about 20 years inside Washington, D.C.'s health policy machine. So she knows it really well. If you have any questions, not just about COVID, which we are going to talk about today, but why healthcare seems to just be getting worse, why insurance gets more expensive and the denials keep coming, why drugs don't seem to work, why hospitals are getting more and more expensive and impersonal. Ask these questions. She knows it all from the rooms where all the planning happened. As you probably know, we are accepting text message questions now. So if you want an anonymous question, just text us at 805-238-5775 KPRL, or you can call and ask. So anyway, that interview is going to come up after the break. And just before that, hopefully I can give a little personal introduction of how I first met her, if we have time. But I have a lot to cover before then. We want to talk about the primary election because it's coming up, 2 weeks from tomorrow, I think it is, to get your ballot in. And I get it. Most people ignore the primaries and figure it's not as important as the final election. Yes, the final election is important, but this primary is really, really crucial because this decides who is going to be even on the ballot for governor. And this is our, basically, it seems like a once in a generation chance to change directions. Everyone's written off California. This time, it looks like we could get real changes in Sacramento. And I don't want to hear about how things are rigged or you don't trust the mail, because whoever has the momentum going into election day, that's where the vote's going to go. So put the momentum behind the candidate you want. And right now, I've been seeing some figures that are really hopeful, and I'll show you why, hopefully show you why early voting is so important. So one of the formerly red districts, which Newsom changed to blue through Prop 50, is trending Republican based on early voting. It's a formerly red seat in San Diego that is now, I think they voted for Kamala Harris by 4 points in the last election. And now there's a substantial lead behind the Republican in that seat. And that's where the momentum is. So going into June 2nd, it's the Democrat who's going to really have to scramble. So let's see. Not only that, what were my other numbers that I had that I wanted to share? Okay, so in 2022, so 4 years ago, at this point, about 54% of Democrats in California had voted already, and only 25% Republicans had voted. So that election, there was no way it was going to look good for Republicans, because number one, Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1, and more than half of them had voted. So the minority of voters, only 25% of them had voted. Now, 41% of Democrats have voted, and 37% Republicans have voted. So that really gives a substantial boost going into the election. So that really has to continue. All right, I'm just going to walk through a few things on the ballot. We've talked about the governor's race, and I will reveal who I voted for. I debated whether to do this, but what the heck. I voted for Chad Bianco, and here's why. Number one is I like to know who I'm voting for. The only politician who I haven't interacted with, actually, who's on the ballot this year, is Steve Hilton, the other Republican. And I've reached out to him and tried to talk to him on the show, and I've not heard back. But so Chad, I have interviewed several times before he declared for governor. He was working to raise his profile statewide, so he was really involved in the ballot initiative to stop retail theft. His wife came with him into the studio when he did this interview. I really liked her as well. They were real people. And one thing that I really like about him is that he has managed California's totally manic policies on the ground as a sheriff for, is Riverside County the largest county? Well, it's a huge county with lots of different people, different constituents to deal with, and a huge landmass as well. So he knows how to deal with some of our most endemic issues, which include chronic homelessness that's rooted in the drug problem and our homeless industrial complex. He knows how to deal with crime, and he really stood up to Newsom's COVID mandates, which is huge for me. So I like that. I voted for him. He also gets that the so-called housing crisis is a politician-created crisis that's the result of insane red tape and regulation. Doesn't require all kinds of taxpayer-subsidized gross Soviet housing blocks. That's not the answer. That's Sacramento and Newsom's answer, but that's not the answer. He also is against taxation, which we always love around here. And he is friendly to ag interests, which personally, as you all know, my private life is all ag. So I care about that. I am not voting for Steve Hilton. And this is no shade to those of you who are, if he speaks to you, by all means. But my biggest objection is that not only is he a pretty recent transplant to California, so he doesn't remember what California was like before as a resident. As you probably know, he is British. But just over a decade ago, not long ago at all, he was the head of strategy for Britain's former Prime Minister, David Cameron, who was a very unsuccessful Prime Minister. He helped intensify the UK's immigration crisis. Ultimately, the referendum on him became Brexit. And while Brexit's promises were completely broken by the politicians who came, it just shows how he fed into the status quo that really frustrated the British people, and they really, really tried to stop it. And obviously Brexit didn't work because the establishment didn't let it work. But anyway, that's why I'm not voting for Steve Hilton. And please do not forget the other statewide races. This is really, really, really key. So the bubble for state superintendent of instruction of public schools, even if you don't have kids and grandkids in public school, really you owe it to the future of our state to make sure the majority of our future citizens are not complete morons. If you have children or grandchildren in our public schools, you've seen how the standards have fallen, particularly post-COVID, and you see how the school shutdowns, the fallout just is the gift that keeps on giving. It's a five-alarm fire for our society, I think, and not just our family. And Sonia Shaw cares about making schools about the basics of education. She was actually at the top of the list on my ballot. I'm assuming that's the same for everyone with a ballot from our county. And you know her. She's been on this show several times. She has been a target of Newsom and Attorney General Rob Bonta for years now. After she took over as president of the, is it Temecula Valley? Chino Valley School Board in Southern California. And she and her board passed the first in the state policy against secretly transing kids at school. Obviously, the state powers that be went after her. They went after her in state court, interestingly enough, not federal court, because they knew they could win in state court because they kind of control who are the judges. And ultimately, Sonia has had the last laugh because the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld parental rights and nixed the whole secret transing of kids after Bonta and Newsom spent however much of our money fighting our interests in court. So what I love about Sonia, she's really tough and she really, you know, she stepped up. I think this is how this country was intended to be run, by normal citizens who rise up and self-govern and repudiate the political class when the political class gets out of control. So please don't forget to put some momentum behind her. And I will say the teachers union favorite on that is a current assemblyman who has chaired the education committee. He is completely in the pockets of the teachers unions. I'm blanking on his name. He's an assemblyman in Southern California. But anyway, just vote Sonia Shaw, so you don't even have to worry about that. Then there are also lots of good people on this ballot, and I love that I've talked to most of them. It makes it feel cozy almost, and almost like a high school election. No, just kidding. Much more high stakes than that. For AG, another huge race, we've got to get rid of Rob Bonta. Rob Bonta is so few degrees removed from the federal indictment scandal of bribery in Oakland politics, that he actually used his campaign dollars to hire a lawyer in that case. He and his wife were very, you know, set up a nonprofit so he could funnel donor money to his wife's nonprofit. She now took over his seat. She has been behind some really, really awful laws. They tried to make her in charge of his department budget, which was very shady, and then thankfully that got that got some light shit on it, and that was changed, but they just kind of reek of corruption, he and his wife. Basically, he is running on his record of spending tons of our money suing the Trump administration over anything and everything. That's what he likes to do. And lots of money, lots of our money goes to private law firms in order to do that. So the Republican running against him is Michael Gates. He was the city attorney for Huntington Beach during COVID and successfully fought some of Newsom's COVID mandates. He also just was kind of part of the whole cohort from Huntington Beach when they kind of set up this mini rebel republic standing up against everything Newsom was doing. So that's who he is. He has experience just kind of fighting the system. He was tapped by Trump for Trump's second term to be U.S. attorney, but he is running for attorney general. So the next race that is really, really, really important to vote in is the state insurance commissioner. Please vote for this one. And here's why. So the current commissioner, Ricardo Lara, I've talked about him on the show. He's just been such an absolute disaster. I can't believe he got reelected last time. I think people just don't pay attention to who the insurance commissioner is. I hope everyone is now, because we've all seen health insurers flee the state. Policies are going up. Home policies are going up. A lot of people can't even get home insurance policies. Meanwhile, Lara has been using our dollars to gallivant around the world. On our dollar. He's been going to LGBT events, things that have nothing to do with insurance. Or he'll go to these fancy weekends that are literally sponsored by insurance companies. And why was he even in the running for insurance? He had no experience in insurance markets at all. He was, you know, a state politician before then. Well, he's a gay man who is really part of the whole Equality California coalition, and Equality California literally handpicked him because they wanted an insurance commissioner who would make insurance companies cover irreversible surgeries for kids, for minors, for anyone, and wanted someone who could help gay men get surrogates to buy babies. So this is why he was picked. And you can see the implosion that has happened. So please vote for this one. And I would say normally that anyone would be better than what we have, but there is a disaster candidate on this ballot. Her name is Jane Kim from San Francisco. She is a socialist, and she was actually too radical for San Francisco to elect. In 2016, she ran against Scott Wiener for the state Senate seat. He ended up winning. We all know how much we love Scott Wiener. Well, apparently Jane Kim was even too crazy to beat him. So important to vote on this one. One of the candidates, the one that I voted for, was Stacey Korsgaden, who is an insurance agent. And I just found out she's actually from our county. She's from San Luis Obispo. She is getting attacked in state media because she apparently attended the infamous January 6th rally of 2021. And they're really trying to make this a thing. But I don't know if that's a thing still for people. Although, actually, I shouldn't say that. I do know people who would still get upset about that. I mentioned Scott Wiener. Speaking of him, if you do know anyone in San Francisco, his common sense opponent, Marie Hurriabel, who's supported by a lot of people who've been on this show, you know, our feisty group of San Francisco women fighting for women's spaces, she is actually now polling at 10%. She popped into the race late, basically because no one sensible was stepping up. So she just decided to step in and become the target. And this is huge. And she's actually drawing some labels from Scott Wiener, which are completely false. But, you know, that's what he does. He labels everyone homophobic and transphobic, et cetera, if he can, because he can't engage with critiques of his actual policy. So anyway, he is scared of her. This is the race to replace Nancy Pelosi. So it's likely a lifetime seat at San Francisco. You know, once you're in that seat, you'll probably keep it. So, you know how bad Scott Wiener has been for California. He's been pushing behind the push to eliminate women's spaces, including bathrooms and sports. He passed a law to let sex pests off the offender registry. He has passed the law that allows courts to take out-of-state kids from their parents if they come here for sex changes. He has been behind a lot of the pro-crime bills. He wrote the law that has essentially legalized open-air prostitution and led to all kinds of human rights tragedies on the streets of Los Angeles and San Francisco. At least if he stuck with his state Senate seat, he'd be termed out. But just imagine him on a national scale in a lifetime seat, sneaking under a Democratic president, sneaking laws through the massing spending omnibuses that nobody looks at, and nationalizing the harm he's done in California on the national scale. Oh, I haven't even gotten into the whole women's prison issue, which I've harped on. I can't believe I neglected to say that. So think of that. Think of him doing what he's done to California on a national scale and use that motivation to call anyone and everyone you know who lives in San Francisco. This is big. Again, this will determine whether Marie Hurriabell is even on the ballot in November when she's up against him. So, unfortunately, I didn't get to tell my personal story about how I know our upcoming guest, Katie Tolento, but we will hear a lot of great things from her when we come back from this break. So stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back. You're listening to Free Talk California.
Ace Auto Care in Atascadero, the best price and service on brakes, tires, smog checks, oil changes, and more. Ace Auto Care, all your vehicle needs, everything you want.
Fox News, I'm Tom Graham. The Trump administration announcing the creation of a $1.7 billion fund to compensate those allegedly mistreated by the Biden-era Justice Department.
Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche says the fund sets up a lawful process for victims of lawfare and weaponization. Government watchdogs and Democrats say the fund has little oversight and will benefit friends of the president with meritless claims.
Fox's Jared Halpert, a jury ruling against Elon Musk over his lawsuit against OpenAI and its CEO, Sam Altman. Musk co-founded the company. He says it violated the founding mission as a nonprofit. OpenAI now operates as for-profit. Fox's Kelly Saberi.
Both sides have accused each other of being hypocritical. Musk's team has tried to paint Altman as an untrustworthy businessman.
Federal jury finding Musk exceeded the statute of limitations in bringing the case. America is listening to Fox News.
Hi, it's Brian Carroll from A1 Glass. Get rewarded when you upgrade to Milgard windows and doors and earn up to $100 back per patio door and up to $40 back per Milgard window. Enjoy better comfort, energy efficiency, a home that looks incredible, and huge savings. Don't wait, the spring sales event ends June 8th. Plus, A1 Glass is your local family-owned award-winning team, voted best on the Central Coast. A1 Glass, for all your glass needs.
Qualifying Milgard products only. Rewards issued as electronic gift cards. See A1 Glass for details.
Hi, welcome back to Free Talk California. I'm Susanna Luthi, and joining us from, I'll just say, the Washington, D.C. area is Katie Tolento. Welcome, Katie.
Hi, Susanna. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear yours. I'm so excited about our conversation today, and I've been given a few questions to ask you by other people because they're all excited. And just a reminder to listeners, if you want to call in or text, that number is 238-5775. So, all right. Let's go back to, well, let's just kind of walk through your past in D.C. because you were really part of the medical policy establishment of D.C. I think that's fair to say. So when did you get into the health policy space? Because you were working in the Senate before you went to the White House, I believe, right?
Yep, that's right. I was, I got out of grad school. I got a degree in infectious disease epidemiology. And so I came out of there. I worked in HIV AIDS a little bit for a while, for a few years. And then I got sucked into working on the Senate side because I just happened to live and go to church on Capitol Hill. So that, you know, what's going to happen. So anyway,
yes.
I end up on Capitol Hill. I worked for the Senate committee that oversees HHS, and I did the public health portfolio, which was like CDC and NIH and bioterrorism and stuff like that. And that was 2001. And so many, many moons ago. And I ended up working on and off for five different senators, Republican senators, and a couple committees. I took 2 years out to be a nun. And then I
did
back.
Not know that, really.
Yeah. And anyway, I like to say that one of those senators drove me to the nunnery because we used to fight like an old married couple. But yeah, so I did that for 15 years. I always kind of regretted every time I had to come back because I never really liked government or didn't really respect government. But, you know, it's a company town. And when you live in Washington, that's what you end up doing. So I did that. And then the last senator I worked for, the chief of staff, a friend of mine, left the office to go work for the Trump campaign. And he, the next time I saw him, he was like disheveled, chain smoking, sleep deprived. And so I, out of, you know, sympathy and human empathy, I offered to help him. What does he need help with? And he was in charge of policy issues. And so I offered to work on healthcare and values issues. And so I got sucked into Trump world. That was spring of 2016. So from there to the campaign staff and then to presidential transition and then into the White House where I ran. I was in charge of healthcare issues and values issues on the Domestic Policy Council.
And maybe I can sneak in my little personal anecdote about how I met you. So I was responsible and I had some factual things wrong, but it was a very kind of sneaky article when you were, I think it was a regulation that defunded Planned Parenthood through Title IX, which is the family planning program. And at that point, I was pretty much
Title
a spokesperson.
Title 10, Title 9.
I know what Title IX is. Anyway, I was pretty much a spokesperson for Planned Parenthood at the time in that story, and I regret it very much. But after that, shortly after that, the Susan B. Anthony List people, who it's a pro-life group, they very kindly reached out. I actually became friends with their spokesperson and invited me to their Christmas party, and you were there. And they said, oh, she's the reporter. And you were like, can't talk. And you left.
Yeah.
And then we
so
became friends after that.
Yes. I was so mad at them that they had press at this like party with my friends. And I'm like,
oh, yeah,
yes.
Good.
They kept telling me, she's great. Give her a chance.
Anyway, it took me some time, and I had to become Catholic before I realized how evil abortion is. But I think I knew, but you know, to admit it, because it's that was one of those issues that the cool kids were very anti the pro-life movement. So
yeah, well, I can relate to being you know, a little bit regretful about previous career choices.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, so let's go back to the White House and let's go back to 2020, because this is the you know, the big event in our country that there's never been a reckoning, and it still haunts most of us, maybe not Floridians because life stayed pretty normal for them. But had you left the White House by the time COVID hit?
Yeah, I left in the middle of 2019. Thank God I had enough on my conscience at that point. But I was shilling for the president's reelect. So he was running for reelection, and there was nobody who knew public health who both supported the president and wasn't already on the inside. So, like, every possible public health loyalist was snatched up because there aren't that many. Mm-hmm. And so I was the only one. And so I would go on TV and, like, defend the president's COVID response, even as I was growing increasingly cognitively dissonant about the COVID response.
When did you become questioning of the COVID response? How early on?
So immediately I was totally on board with, like, Team COVIDian. I was friends with Debbie Birx. I never liked Tony Fauci, but nobody did. But I was friends with Debbie, and I thought it was very good that she, was running the White House COVID thing, and it would go better for America if she was, and whatever. And so I appreciated the awesome, like, 2-hour-long press conferences. I thought that was really great and transparent. But then, as the time went on, and it was this masking, like, religion, and the lockdowns and the 6 feet, it was the unscientific interventions that didn't conform with the epidemiology of the disease that made me think something's up. You know, like, why are they lying about masks? Why are they lying about this 6 feet business? Why do these lockdowns have, you know, you can pull your mask down when you're eating, but not when you walk into the restaurant? This is all stupid. It's theater. I don't like it. And so that was the beginning of sort of my, something's up here.
Were you talking to people at the White House at the time and asking them any of this?
No, let me think. Not really, no. I was more talking to the campaign people who were just, you know, setting me up for media booking, right? It wasn't, I was not really, I was engaging a little bit. I did have some conversations with Debbie, but not really about, like, why are we doing this? You guys are stupid. None of that.
Right. And at this point, I was at Politico on the health team, and we were probably at the, I mean, I think all the mainstream media outlets were, but we were really at the forefront of defending all of these stupid policies and shaming anyone who would break them, especially the masks, the 6 feet apart. And then we reporters would get together, and a couple of my reporter friends, we would meet outside, and they'd want to stay 6 feet apart from me. And I was like, do you really believe this? But they seemed to. But then after we'd break out the bottle of wine, you know, everyone forgot that and took off their masks. But I want to reference a Substack article that just made the rounds. I sent it to a bunch of people. It was called Confessions of a White House Public Health Priestess. And you talk about your awakening, and I encourage everyone to go to your Substack, which is at katietalento.com. That's Katie with a Y, not an IE. But this really hit hard because this portion of your article really hit hard because we did this at Politico, where pretty early on we were demonizing any treatment that seemed to be effective for, you know, people out there, but it wasn't endorsed by the Beltway. And we were pushing treatments that I was hearing firsthand from people were actually harmful, like remdesivir was a drug that was really being pushed. And one of my friend's mothers was given it when she got COVID, and she ended up with, I think, liver failure. Might have been kidney failure. Yes. Mm-hmm. And one of the editors kind of laughingly acknowledged that remdesivir didn't make sense for us to be pushing, but there was zero public questioning of it. Instead, there was just all the shaming of ivermectin, hydrochloroquine. I was sent to a White House press conference specifically to ask why Trump was talking about hydrochloroquine, and he did not call on me, so I didn't get to ask that question. But you talked about why it was important for the establishment to attack any remedy that might be effective. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so all the countermeasures, such as masks or drugs or vaccines, once they came out, and any kind of therapies, were protected under a PREP Act declaration. So the PREP Act is Public Health Response and Emergency Preparedness Act, and it creates this emergency use it doesn't create emergency use authorization. That status already existed at FDA. But it's a status that a product can have that has not been through the FDA approval process that is used in an emergency, like what we thought we had. And so if the secretary makes a certain declaration and puts certain types of products under the PREP Act, then anything within emergency use authorization, an EUA, or an FDA-approved product that is in that category in the declaration has legal liability for their manufacturers. So you can't sue a drug maker if that drug is under an EUA-protected status under the PREP Act. But it's that legal liability only accrues if there is no other available adequate drug or therapy that is an alternative. And so what that means is, as they were developing, whether it's remdesivir, which was a brand name drug, or whether it was a vaccine that was to come out, none of those products, before they had FDA approval, or even after they had FDA approval, would have, you could have sued Pfizer for hurting you with the COVID vaccine if there had been some drug that was recognized by the government as effective or adequate and available for COVID. And so we had to delegitimize hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and any of the other drugs that were out there because they were already FDA approved and therefore, considered safe. And they were adequate. They were available, widely available. And if they turned out to be, if the government recognized them as effective, well, then these other products that were not FDA approved would lose their legal liability protection.
And we were just
protecting pharma.
Yes, we were just the stooges in the press, and it was like we just were told, this is ivermectin is horse dewormer. That was a very effective tagline. And now that I live on a ranch and we use ivermectin all the time, it's for our animals. It's not as effective because, like, oh yeah, it works for everything for the animals. So it probably does some good, but it was just like, who sent out this memo? Where was this decided? Do you think? You probably don't know firsthand, but where was this decided, do you think, where we had to demonize, the media had to demonize these other treatments, the government had to shrug them off? And what was the establishment thinking, do you imagine, when Trump was going off the cuff at the press conferences and saying, oh yeah, you can use hydroxychloroquine or these other treatments?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There was no memo, obviously, as far as we know. But I suspect that the vaccine manufacturers who were feverishly working under Operation so-called Warp Speed to basically shorten safety trials and get them done real fast, it was all on the promise that they were going to have massive government procurement of their products, even though their products had not received FDA approval yet. And so they were going around the world to every country and saying, if you don't immunize us from lawsuits arising from harmed patients who take our vaccines, we won't sell our vaccines in your market, in your country. And they were doing the same thing with the U.S. So they knew. So I suspect it was originating from the vaccine makers as they were developing their vaccines all during 2020, when all these other treatments were being considered because we didn't have a vaccine yet. And so people were looking for any help to survive this disease. And so I think it started there and it probably came to HHS. And, I'll never forget the FDA tweeting out like, hey, America, y'all aren't horses, so stop taking this
right
medication.
Yep.
But I had worked in Africa where we had worked on disease eradication, like river blindness, which is a terrible, I think it's called onchocerciasis, is a terrible blinding disease caused by a parasite. And we do, you know, the WHO had handed out ivermectin like candy because it cured that disease. And it was well known to be not only anti-parasitic, but anti-inflammatory. And it's no surprise that it was effective and that it's still effective for a number of things. And meanwhile, the hydroxychloroquine trials that were going on around the world, there were studies, both observational studies and other studies, that were showing they were effective, but those had to be silenced in the U.S.
Wow. Well, we're already up to our next break, and we'll have about 11 minutes when we come back, so there's a lot to cover, but I'll ask a few of the questions that I was given when we come back. So stay with us, everyone. You're listening to Free Talk California. Our guest is Katie Tolento, epidemiologist, and we are going to talk about lots more when we come back. Stay with us.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Lauren Simonetti, and this is the Fox Business Report.
A choppy trading session with stocks ending mixed and off of session lows after late in the trading day, President Trump posted on his Truth Social account that he's holding off on a military strike on Iran, which was planned for Tuesday due to serious negotiations. Oil prices continue to rise, fueling inflation fears, with West Texas Intermediate crude hovering at around $106 a barrel, while Brent crude, the international benchmark, is back over $109. Tech and industrials were the worst performers, while energy and financials gained. Shares of the Magnificent Seven big cap tech stocks were mixed. The Dow winners, Visa, 3M, and Travelers. The Dow decliners, Caterpillar, Nvidia, and United Health Group. The Dow rising 160 points. The Nasdaq lower by 134. S&P 500 down 5. That's your Fox Business Report. I'm Hillary Barsky, invested in you.
You're probably listening to this in your car, so let me ask you. Would you drive without insurance? Of course not. So why is your retirement portfolio unprotected? Gold is portfolio insurance. It helps de-risk your savings when markets get unpredictable. Noble Gold Investments has helped thousands of Americans do exactly that, with no high-pressure sales and thousands of five-star reviews. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com. Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals involves risk. Consult with your tax or financial professional before making any investment decisions.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
The California Mid-State Fair in Paso Robles is proud to present Willie Nelson and Family. July 22nd, the California Mid-State Fair in Paso Robles. Dream Chaser, coming May 29th. Tickets on sale Friday, May 22nd at 10 a.m. at MidStateFair.com and Ticketmaster.com. Don't miss Willie Nelson and Family live.
Welcome back to Free Talk California. I'm Susanna Luthi, speaking with Katie Tolento. So, Katie, I'm going to ask this question before we move on to your new ventures. This is from my husband, who said, how could Fauci, who presumably bleeds like the rest of us, push on his conscience, with a clear conscience, push an experimental vaccine on the entire population?
Well, remember, he's a scientist. He's a researcher. His entire career has been at the NIH, where they do studies. So he's not remotely afraid of, you know, using people as lab rats. That's what studies are. And so I don't think it would even occur to him that, like, that's a bad thing. Like, studies are how we have advancements in science. But you know, most of us would have a little bit of conscience. But he has a long history. In fact, Secretary Kennedy wrote a book about his long history of unethical research trials back in the early AIDS days. He was using foster children institutionalized in sort of government orphanages and halfway houses to do invasive and outrageous unethical experiments using AIDS drugs, forcing those drugs into them through IVs and through other surgical procedures. I mean, it was really, truly awful. Many dozens of children died and were buried in mass graves that were uncovered later. I mean, this is the Fauci that we know. He's not a good guy.
Hmm. Did you have any inkling of this? Because you must have worked with him when you were dealing with the NIH and CDC in the Senate.
Yeah, I never worked closely with him. I had a variety of encounters over the years. I'm not even sure before I got to the White House he would have even known my name or known anything about me. But he is someone that we used to joke about that, like, don't get between Fauci and a camera. And that was long before COVID. You know, that's always been how he was.
Huh. Yes, I had met him for the first time when I was sitting next to him at a press club lunch, and he was talking about the flu vaccine. And yes, he was very friendly with the press. I will say that.
Yes, indeed.
So when did you begin to get a little worried about the COVID vaccine?
Yeah, so I was always kind of worried. I don't love the idea of, you know, speeding up safety trials. That's not great in my mind. I had no idea at that time just how shoddy the entire vaccine schedule safety trials had been for all vaccines. I did not know that at the time. But so I wasn't thrilled about this trial. It turns out that the COVID vaccine trials were the most rigorous trials of all the vaccines on the childhood schedule. Like, it was the only one where there was actually randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials. Like, none of the others even have that. But I didn't know that at the time. And so when I got scared was when I saw this weird legal shenanigan that the FDA pulled, whereby they gave FDA approval to a product out of Germany that was not in, it was biochemically equivalent to the drug, to the vaccine that was going in everyone's arms in the U.S., but it was not the vaccine going in those arms. They extended the EUA on the vaccine we were all getting, but the FDA approved this other vaccine. And after that, you know, everyone was like, oh, the vaccine's approved, everything's cool. And I realized they could only be doing this because they can't mandate a vaccine that doesn't have FDA approval. So they have to give FDA approval, or at least the appearance of FDA approval. And sure enough, 2 weeks after that announcement in August of 2021, President Biden announced nationwide mandates of the vaccine for all employers, all the federal government, DOD, schools, everywhere. And, you know, I realized, like, this is bad. They did this just to make it look like they had approved this vaccine, even though that's not what's going in everyone's arms. And I was extremely suspicious after that. I started listening to then, you know, not yet Secretary Kennedy's podcast, and I started reading his book on Mr. Fauci, and I started watching a movie by Del Bigtree called Vaxxed about the original CDC studies on autism in the vaccine schedule. And so that's really when my eyes were opened, and I felt like a fool having been an epidemiologist my entire career and thinking that vaccines were the greatest thing ever. And I felt very foolish and embarrassed for not having known these things.
What would you tell people now, parents, about the childhood vaccine schedule?
I would say that the childhood, there's no product on that schedule that has ever been studied for very long and with a placebo-controlled saline randomized trial. And so what that means is that this is the only product in the entire economy that you cannot sue the manufacturer for if it harms you or your child. And so, and yet, we have these shoddy trials that are not remotely as good as we require of drugs that do have product liability. Mm-hmm. So there's no product liability, and they don't have to go through serious safety trials. Most manufacturers want to go through good safety trials because they have product liability. They can be sued and lose a ton of money if they have dangerous drugs. But vaccine makers, they don't. And so this quality of the data, if you look at, you can read it in section 6.1 of the FDA label in every vaccine. Ask your doctor for section 6.1 of that label. It's a little wrapped up piece of paper in the package. And it'll show you, like, hey, we studied this for 5 days on 100 kids, you know, and they weren't even little babies like we're asking to put in your baby. They were grown older kids. I mean, these studies are just absolutely piss poor quality.
What is RFK up against now, as he has did the slight modification of the vaccine schedule? It did not go far enough for a lot of people. What is he up against, and are you optimistic that he can do more?
Well, first of all, I'm optimistic because we're having this conversation, and it's gone mainstream. And because of that, half of all parents expressed some skepticism when asked about the vaccine schedule. And I think that that's a really positive conversation. And it will help science going forward to have to be more rigorous if they want to sell their products to a skeptical parent population. With respect to the secretary, you know, yes, this judge struck down his new, like, even limited reduction of the vaccine to match the Danish vaccine schedule, which is a slightly more rational, and has not resulted in mass die-offs of children from vaccine-preventable diseases. But the judge struck it down on the technicality, really. Like, you hadn't, your advisory committee wasn't made up of the right kind of people, or didn't match the charter. And these are easy problems to fix. And I hope and I believe the department is fixing the problem, and then we'll reconstitute the advisory committee and reinstate their recommendations, and they will pass that court's muster.
Are we anywhere close to a really good, vigorous look at the each vaccine on the schedule? Safety tests, double-blind safety tests. Do you think that's going to happen in the next, I don't know, probably not before my children are grown, but are we trending in that direction? As you said, I mean, most of my young mom friends are very, very skeptical. It's completely changed from, you know, before I was a mom, I never knew anyone who was skeptical. Now it's hard to find anyone who isn't a little skeptical.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And no, I don't think that there is going to be a rigorous study, or, you know, actually performing the type of rigorous studies that we require on drugs for these vaccines. The vast majority of them are, you know, cheap generics, and even if they weren't, the manufacturer has zero incentive to conduct these studies. Why on earth would they? And, you know, I guess the NIH in theory could conduct them themselves if they wanted to, but clinical trials that are run right are very expensive and they take many years. And I think it's probably more likely that what we're going to see is just more honesty in the labels, more honesty required in guidelines put out to, you know, pediatricians, and more clear definitions around what informed consent means, because they're supposed to give informed consent, or obtain informed consent from parents before they vaccinate a child, and that's really not happening today. There's this cheesy CDC one-pager that is given to parents, you know, often after the vaccine has gone in the arm. So, I don't think we're going to get the science we want. I think we're going to have to do, and also because the public health enterprise has claimed that we can't do placebo-controlled trials because it's unethical to have a placebo group where you don't give a child a vaccine. Why? Well, because vaccines save lives. Well, but we don't know that. We need to study to make sure they save lives, or save more lives than they take. Well, but they save lives, so we can't have a group that doesn't get a vaccine. So they've only said we can't do that kind of trial, and that's why we're not going to do them now. Because it's a circular argument. We can't study to see if vaccines are safe and effective because they're safe and effective, so we can't have a control group that doesn't receive the vaccine because they're safe. You know, it's just circular.
Right.
So I don't think we will get those studies. I think instead the market is going to speak.
Where can we find your, what are you doing now, first of all, in the last minute? And where can we find your writing and more of your work?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. So I run a company where I help build health plans for employers, many of which are faith-based employers or Catholic dioceses and then other employers. And we try to build, like, kind of rehumanize health plans, refire the carrier and fire the bigs. But also, now that I'm no longer a government staffer, I am finally speaking in my own voice at katiepalento.com.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much. We are out of time, unfortunately. I have so many more questions for you, but we'll have to have you on another time. But thanks so much for coming on, and thanks to all of you for tuning in. This was Free Talk California. I'm Susanna Luthi, and our guest was Katie Talento. We will see you next week.
Talk California is brought to you by A-Town Diner in Atascadero on El Camino Real. Now open for dinner every night. Ask about the daily specials. AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.
It's 2 o'clock.